Chapter 6. Banding Together. What's true of all the evils in the world is true of the plague as well. It helps men to rise above themselves. All the same, when you see the misery it brings, you'd need to be a madman or a coward or stone blind to give in tamely to the plague. Albert Camus, The Plague, 1947. In the middle of March 2020, Yale's in-person classes were canceled, and Liam Elkind, an undergraduate, was home in Manhattan. Looking for a way to help others as the pandemic began to rage, he and a friend founded Invisible Hands, an organization whose goal was to deliver groceries and other necessities to the elderly and other at-risk people in their neighborhood and beyond. As soon as the website went live, volunteer and media interest exploded. Within 4 days, more than 1,200 volunteers had signed up. To reach clients who were unlikely to find it online, Invisible Hands spread the word with old-fashioned flyers that volunteers translated into many languages and tacked up in buildings around the city. Within a month, Invisible Hands had signed up 12,000 volunteers, fielded over 4,000 requests for help, and started a subsidy program to provide some free food, too. Many such organizations sprang into action across the country. Mutual aid societies, which have been around for more than 100 years, have seen a resurgence. The Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Network, for instance, is rooted in the idea of collective, reciprocal care and egalitarian social relations. Mutual aid entails what's often called solidarity, not charity. It isn't a handout from some top-down entity, nor someone's paid employment. It embodies a spirit of empathy, generosity, and dignity, its website noted. Other support networks, like COVID-19 Mutual Aid USA, compiled resources for those who wanted to help and those in need of help by curating detailed lists of all mutual aid networks in every state and town. One radio station in San Francisco maintained a website of dozens of links for a dizzying array of local mutual aid societies. People could click on a link and fill in a form to request or offer assistance, from help with food or healthcare to assistance with tenants' rights or shelter. Similarly, Mutual Aid New York City compiled organizations in multiple categories, including elder care, delivery and transport, internet and technology, mental health, safety, and pet care. Americans volunteered to help their neighbors and their communities in other ways, by supporting or staffing food banks and helping with shopping. People donated their time to produce cloth masks or talk by phone to others who were struggling with loneliness. Librarians repurposed their facilities for an astonishing array of services, providing meals, free Wi-Fi, or 3D printers to make PPE, or serving as temporary homeless shelters. Many Americans continued to pay their employees, even though they were not at work, out of a desire to both sustain their businesses and help their workers. Countless people who could afford to, and many who could not, increased their charitable giving. College students and medical students who were stuck at home organized to provide childcare to healthcare workers and other employees crucial to the operation of hospitals, such as custodians and cafeteria workers. One group in Minnesota, called COVID Sitters, matched hundreds of volunteers to people who needed childcare. This model was subsequently copied around the country. "The people who are out there truly need help, and I just wanted to be part of the solution," said public school teacher Danielle Chalfie, who volunteered to care for the children of frontline healthcare workers. "I'm taking care of things for them at home so they can go out and take care of people out there." According to a survey conducted in late May 2020, 37% of Americans reported having donated their money, supplies, or time to help others in their community, and 75% said they had supported local businesses since the start of the pandemic. Many Americans also reported checking in on their elderly or sick neighbors, 43%, and potentially exposing themselves to the virus to help others, 17%. Conversely, 14% of people asked for help from others in their community, and 16% reported having received help. Americans are famously charitable. Alexis de Tocqueville admired the country's mutual aid societies when he traveled around the young country in 1831, compiling observations for his prescient book, Democracy in America. In this respect, at least, not much has changed in two centuries. Our country ranks first in the world for charitable donations, and on a per capita basis, Americans donate more than 7 times as much as Europeans, perhaps unsurprisingly, given our wealth, religiosity, and favorable tax structure. Not even Canada, our geographic and cultural neighbor, comes close to the level of philanthropy seen in the United States. Even more striking, individual donations make up 81% of American charitable giving, far more than is donated by foundations, 14%, or corporations, just 5%. It should not really surprise anyone, then, that exceptional acts of kindness are found alongside the baser and more self-serving actions we have seen during the pandemic. A survey of over 11,000 respondents in March 2020 found that 46% of people agreed that COVID-19 was bringing out the best in Americans, which was about as many as thought it was bringing out the worst. And most Americans, 61%, reported having a lot of faith in the goodness and altruism of their fellow citizens, a percentage no different from 2018. But there is something unusual about the kind of generosity we see during an epidemic, when the act of generosity itself can pose material health risks. It's one thing to donate money, time, or blood after a hurricane. It's quite another to deliver groceries to a housebound neighbor when there is a possibility that you might get infected in the process. Altruism in the time of contagion asks us to put the needs of others, often strangers, ahead of our own. We see this kind of selflessness especially among doctors, nurses, firefighters, teachers, and the like, people who are trained to prioritize the needs of the more vulnerable. Writer Ernest Hemingway saw this up close during World War I. At age 19, recovering from his own injuries incurred as an ambulance driver, he watched the nurse he had fallen in love with, Agnes von Kurowski, attend to a young soldier dying of the Spanish flu. Hemingway was apparently deeply rattled to see the young man appear to drown in his own phlegm. In a letter about the scene, in which she referred to Hemingway as the kid, von Kurowski expressed intense sorrow at the loss of this sweet and lovely and smiling man who had died in her arms. She later explained that trained nurses are usually noted for being reckless with their own health while trying hard to keep up that of others. Hemingway was so struck by her selfless courage that he based an untitled short story on the incident. In it, the narrator admits, "It was the first man I had seen die of the influenza, and it frightened me. The two nurses cleaned him up, and I went back to my room and washed my hands and face and gargled and got back into bed. I had offered to help them clean up, but they did not want that. When I was alone in the room, I found I was very frightened by the way Connor had died, and I did not go back to sleep. I was frightened into a panic. After a while, the nurse I was in love with opened the door and came into the room and over to the bed." But the narrator is afraid to be in the presence of his lover for fear of contagion, and he admits as much after she remarks, "You're too afraid to kiss me." After a pause, the selfless nurse declares that she would have sucked the mucus in the patient all out with a tube if it would have done any good. But regular people, too, are willing to take risks and contribute to society. For instance, many of those who recovered from COVID-19 returned to hospitals in order to donate their blood for a possible antibody treatment, which we will cover in more detail later. The Hasidic Jewish population of Brooklyn, who were especially hard hit by COVID-19, have made the most disproportionate contributions to this cause, according to a Mayo Clinic researcher. "By far the largest group is our Orthodox friends in New York City," he reported. When blood banks had filled up in the New York regions, members of this deeply insular community traveled through the night by car to Pennsylvania and Delaware to donate their blood, receiving permission from their rabbis to travel on the Sabbath if necessary. "We look at it as a gift that we recovered," a donor explained. "Everybody here has the gift of these antibodies, and they want to use them to save people." Even wearing a mask is partly an act of kindness, and there is no guarantee that the generosity will be reciprocated. Moreover, in some parts of the country, wearing a mask is grounds for exclusion from stores and restaurants because of the misguided belief that they reflect paranoia or some kind of un-American opposition to liberty. "I want customers that aren't sheep," one tavern owner said. But the wearing of masks reflects altruism, since the mask wearers derive more limited protection from their own masks, in most cases, as we saw in Chapter 3. These acts of kindness, solidarity, and cooperation are not unique to the COVID-19 pandemic. They have been seen in virtually every epidemic in human history. Polio survivor Ann Finger described the extraordinary generosity of local families when she was hospitalized in 1954. "She received so many presents, she felt buried in the sand up to her neck," she said. When her father went to buy gas, he was told that it was already taken care of. Unlike war or famine or natural disasters, such as hurricanes or earthquakes, during which people can gather together, an epidemic is a collective catastrophe that must be experienced separately. An invisible force pushes us physically apart. For centuries in times of plague, people have sheltered at home, avoiding their neighbors and friends, and even died alone. And we have seen how epidemic disease can inflame darker tendencies, fostering fear, anger, and blame. But epidemics also offer us the opportunity, indeed the necessity, to band together. They highlight our shared vulnerability and our common humanity. Like other collective threats, epidemics call for solidarity. Luckily, human beings have evolved traits that help: love, cooperation, and teaching. Love and connection can make suffering more bearable. Experiments show that if a person is obliged to undergo something painful, like having pressure applied to an index finger, or stressful, like immersing a foot in 3 inches of cold water, the pain is tolerated better when his or her spouse is present. Sometimes, the analgesic and stress-relieving effects of love can be activated just by thinking about a partner or spouse. And maintaining a romantic relationship in a time of crisis can be invaluable. Historian Miriam Slater vividly remembers the story of a married couple she knew as a child who had met and fallen in love in a concentration camp during World War II. "They were separated in the concentration camp. He told me he would sneak out and go to the fence, and she'd come to the fence, and they would see each other through the fence. I said, 'How would you manage that? That's very dangerous.' He said, 'The Nazis would beat you up if they found you there, but she was worth the beating.'" Research in disaster psychology suggests that the effect of natural and man-made disasters on partnerships depends heavily on context. In some instances, disasters can directly foster marital instability via economic or mental health problems like job loss or depression. However, some people rely on spousal support during times of danger. When thoughts of death become more salient, it's quite natural to grow closer to loved ones in order to form cognitive or physical buffers against the fear of death. For example, one experiment found that after undergraduate students were asked questions that made thoughts of their own mortality more prominent, "Please briefly describe the emotions that the thought of your own death arouses in you," and "What do you think happens to you as you physically die and once you are physically dead?" they reported higher commitment to their romantic partner than did those who were assigned to an emotionally neutral group or one focusing on physical pain. The impulse to marry during a crisis is sometimes fueled not only by a heightened sense of intimacy, but by pragmatic concerns. On the eve of the global travel shutdown in March 2020, Columbia University astroengineering students Natalie Hager and Mikhail Karasev were deeply in love, but facing the prospect of an intolerable separation. Hager, a German citizen, was heading home to Berlin, but Karasev, a Russian citizen, was barred from entering the European Union. They struggled at first to find a solution, but then arranged a quick marriage at City Hall. Karasev was subsequently, after myriad hurdles, given a German residency permit so they could fly to Berlin together. The 21-year-old explained that he did not see the accelerated marriage as a risk. I really want to spend the rest of my life with this person. I felt this was really fast, but it was the only way we could stay together. Marriage rates have spiked following previous disasters, too. To some extent, disasters can amplify romantic feelings because of a phenomenon known as the misattribution of arousal, in which people confuse emotional stimulation or even physical danger for a state of romantic arousal. For example, in 1989, Hurricane Hugo hit South Carolina. The Category 4 storm caused over $6 billion in physical damage and affected 40% of all residences. That year, statewide marriage rates increased significantly by an average of 0.70 per 1,000 people, which may sound trivial, but is not, temporarily reversing the steady decline observed over two decades prior to the disaster. Birth rates also experienced a net increase of 41 births per 100,000 people in 1990, and the 24 counties declared disaster areas experienced a particularly notable uptick in birth rates. Marriages increased during the early stages of World War I and II as well, and they spiked during the post-war periods. The year 1942, just after the United States' entry into World War II, experienced the highest recorded marriage rate to that point, 13.1 marriages per 1,000 people, and peaked after the war in 1946, 16.4 marriages per 1,000 people. Marriages at younger than usual and older than usual ages also increased during that war. However, statewide divorce rates in South Carolina significantly increased following Hurricane Hugo as well, with the 24 counties that were declared disaster areas exhibiting the greatest increase in divorce rates. And wars have also been shown to influence divorce. Divorce rates peaked 4.3 per 1,000 population for a total of 610,000 divorces and annulments in 1946, following the end of World War II, and decreased to 2.8 by 1948. The divorce rate rose during and just after the Vietnam War, 1965 to 1973, too. These observations lend credence to the assertion by psychotherapist Esther Perel that crises are a relationship accelerator. They tend to hasten happy couples to increase their commitment and nudge unhappy ones to part ways. Given the complexity of the link between catastrophe and romantic behavior, the impact of COVID-19 on how people fall in love or how their intimate relationships fare remains to be seen. For instance, it does seem that domestic violence spiked during the stay-at-home orders in the spring of 2020. While some estimates found a 25% decrease in total crime, domestic violence rates were up by at least 5% in five of the nation's big cities. In Chicago, domestic violence calls to the police rose 7% during the city's shelter-in-place order when compared to the same period in 2019. But in New York City, where police reports of domestic violence were down by 15% compared to the previous year, advocates cautioned that many victims might lack the privacy or freedom to report abuse during the city's dramatic restrictions. Police Commissioner Dermot Shea said that he was concerned that it's happening and it's not getting reported. The pandemic also influenced romantic behavior in other ways. Early anecdotal evidence suggests that the COVID-19 pandemic is stoking old flames and increasing intimacy. Americans are feeling lonelier than usual during the pandemic, which might be why self-isolated people are increasingly reaching out to their exes via text or through direct messaging on social media. The increased production and consumption of social media content, the unsated desire for romantic connection imposed by physical distancing, and the fact that people are reevaluating their lives during the stressful times might all be playing a role in exes coming out of the woodwork. A survey of 6,004 members of the dating site Match.com conducted in April 2020 found that only 6% of singles had dated through video chat prior to the pandemic, but after the pandemic struck, 69% said that they were open to video chatting to meet a possible partner. Because the pandemic is lengthening the dating process, people have more time to develop a more reliable type of slow love, which might contribute to more lasting marriages after the pandemic ends. According to biological anthropologist Helen Fisher, during this pandemic, singles are likely to share far more meaningful thoughts of fear and hope and get to know vital things about a potential partner fast. Such revelations and the vulnerability they communicate can foster intimacy, love, and commitment. But for those simply looking for sexual connections, the New York City Health Department had some creative advice. In a startlingly frank and optimistic fact sheet about safe sex during the coronavirus pandemic, the department encouraged New Yorkers to pick larger, more open, and well-ventilated spaces for their group sex encounters, and told them to be creative with sexual positions and physical barriers like walls when engaged in activities involving two people. When the pandemic began, our species' innate capacities for connection and cooperation were tested by people having to affirmatively work together to implement physical distancing measures. While avoiding close contact can go against human nature, the very fact that we were able to band together to form a coordinated response to the threat we faced reflects other profound evolved capacities. Numerous examples appeared of physically distant individuals who nevertheless joined together to cope with the pandemic in symbolically powerful ways. One of my favorites emerged in late March and early April 2020. Orchestra musicians, all of them isolated in their own homes, recorded themselves individually performing their parts in a symphony. The videos were then edited together to show each musician playing beautifully. The New York Philharmonic's rendition of Ravel's Bolero reduced many people to tears. It was a perfect illustration of how our social species can cooperate when separated. Many ordinary people around the world did the same thing, jointly making music at a distance from balconies and on the streets. The spontaneity of some of these gestures was an even more powerful illustration of our innate capacity for cooperation. A key point about physical distancing and staying at home is that people are not doing these things primarily to help themselves, but rather to help one another. That took a while to sink in. Early in the pandemic, many people seemed to think that the brave and altruistic thing to do was to go about their business and show that they were not afraid of the virus. Some politicians also took this approach. As the pandemic was beginning to reach Texas in late March 2020, and before it crushed the state in July, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, with an almost stereotypical Texas swagger, suggested that elderly people would be willing to risk death to help their community avoid economic hardship. No one reached out to me and said, "As a senior citizen, are you willing to take a chance on your survival in exchange for keeping the America that all America loves for your children and grandchildren?" And if that's the exchange, I'm all in, he said. And that doesn't make me noble or brave or anything like that. I just think there are lots of grandparents out there in this country like me, that what we all care about and what we all love more than anything are those children, he added. And I want to, you know, live smart and see this through, but I don't want to see the whole country to be sacrificed, and that's what I see. I understand the idea that many people would be willing to make a sacrifice and even risk death, but I think that the priorities here are reversed. In any case, elderly people deciding to take risks for their own families is different than the government making the decision for them. Around the same time Patrick said this, I was invited to speak to a group of Episcopal priests in New Hampshire to discuss the kind of pastoral work they did and whether they should keep their churches open. Their natural instinct was to do so, they said, just as Jesus welcomed everyone, including the sick. Their motivation was different, but the objective was the same. But I pointed out that in the case of the coronavirus, the compassionate response was to avoid fostering the spread of the disease. If we really wanted to help our neighbors, we had to stay at home. Contact reduction was in fact not a selfish or even a timid thing to do. But it's an odd thing to persuade people that sitting on their couch is an act of generosity. Yet people were more often willing to follow rules regarding physical distancing if they understood it was primarily to help others. After all, humans are moral actors capable of transcending their own self-interest. One study evaluated how public health messaging could be more successful. What was more effective, telling people, follow these steps to avoid getting coronavirus, or telling them, follow these steps to avoid spreading coronavirus? It turns out that the emphasis on the public threat of coronavirus is at least as effective as, and sometimes more so than, the emphasis on the personal threat. This is in keeping with other work that shows that people are motivated to get vaccinated not only out of self-interest, but also out of a concern for the common good. In the early part of my medical career as a hospice doctor, I often made house calls to patients who were near death, and I had the privilege of hearing their hopes and fears as they faced the end of their lives. One of the most consistent concerns raised again and again was their worry about how their death would affect their families. Seriously ill people, who had only a few weeks or months left to live, would make choices to limit or stop chemotherapy so that their illness would be less burdensome to their family. People would tell me that they were worried about a loved one having to drive them daily for radiation treatment, or they would want to forgo particular drugs with difficult side effects, not to spare themselves pain, but to spare their loved ones. People on the brink of death would tell me that they were worried not so much about their own impending mortality, but about their partner's grief. As social critic Rebecca Solnit has argued, in the wake of major disasters, from earthquakes to hurricanes to bombings, people behave altruistically, working to care for those around them, not just family and friends, but neighbors and complete strangers. Rather than the image of a selfish and violent and barbarous society, red in tooth and claw, people often, or even usually, I think, band together in disasters to confront their shared challenge. Solnit elicited this account from one man after a hurricane struck Halifax, Nova Scotia, in 2003. Everybody woke up the next morning and everything was different. There was no electricity, all the stores were closed, no one had access to media. The consequence was that everyone poured out into the streets to bear witness. It was a sense of happiness to see everybody, even though we didn't know each other. The people worked together to improvise a community kitchen and check on the elderly, and they formed new social relationships in the aftermath. Of course, there is selfishness and violence as well. People take advantage of the chaos for their own ends, to settle old scores, or just to take what they can. Solnit found such stories during Hurricane Katrina. And accounts of plagues over the centuries bear witness to this aspect of human nature. People abandon their friends, blame outsiders, and burn them at the stake, or loot houses with the weakened victims still inside them. But anarchy and selfishness are more often the exception than the rule. In fact, in a phenomenon that Stanford psychologist Jamil Zakai has called catastrophe compassion, survivors typically form communities of mutual aid and they experience greater solidarity. This sense of union and the desire to do good can even result in individuals outside of the disaster zone rushing to the area with donations and volunteering to help. An increased sense of shared identity is very common among those experiencing catastrophes, and this is a powerful source of cooperative behavior and goodwill. One of the ways this happens is that a widely shared peril erodes prior divisions, bringing large numbers of people into the category of us. Everyone becomes part of the group confronting the problem. And the shared adversity creates what is possibly the most important division of all, those who are facing the same threat one is facing and those who are not. That activates an inborn tendency to look kindly upon members of one's own group, and this in turn elicits a natural desire to be good to them. This in-group identity is further reinforced by another common practice we see during pandemics. Individuals are more likely to discuss their shared adverse experiences with each other, including their fears, negative feelings, and sense of vulnerability. Ordinarily, people do not do this with those they do not know well, out of concern about imposing on others, or out of fear that they might be judged adversely or even stigmatized. But when it is abundantly clear that everyone is in the same boat and facing the same fears, self-disclosure becomes less difficult. This in turn fosters trust and builds solidarity, and these deeper connections make mutual help easier. A pandemic, unlike a more focused disaster such as a tornado, creates more spillover consequences from one individual or group to others. The virus observes no boundaries. Hence, the reckless lack of mask wearing by some people may well have serious repercussions for more rule-abiding citizens. In Vermont, normally welcoming locals became incensed when a large group of unmasked motorcyclists from neighboring New York descended on a small town. This is the reason that one state governor deciding to relax physical distancing rules affects us all. An analysis of 22 million mobile phone users found that when people lived in counties that were connected to other counties via social ties or geographic proximity, the stay-at-home rules passed by officials in those latter counties were very effective at keeping people home in the former counties. These sorts of spillover effects can be managed effectively only with the spirit of cooperation. But this cooperation was and remains especially challenging in a large country like the United States when there is limited federal leadership and when uncoordinated approaches to control the virus across states are rife. In the absence of coordination, as one online commentator put it plainly, it feels like designating one end of the swimming pool for urinating and hoping for the best. Altruistic behavior is usually associated with improved subjective well-being and overall mental health for the do-gooder, as long as it does not feel unduly burdensome. Volunteering is often associated with reduced depression and anxiety. This connection between altruism and human psychology is especially critical in the time of COVID-19, when mental health is itself a concern, whether the harm originates from a fear of the virus or from social isolation. And so altruism and cooperation provide an antidote for many of the negative emotions we reviewed in Chapter 4. One particular kind of altruism that got attention during the pandemic was the very real personal risk that healthcare workers, as well as those in other less glamorous occupations, such as grocery clerks and bus drivers, assumed. As we have seen, this phenomenon has accompanied epidemics for thousands of years. During the plague of Athens in 430 BCE, Thucydides observed, "Neither were the physicians at first of any service, ignorant as they were of the proper way to treat it, but they died themselves the most thickly as they visited the sick most often." During the Black Death in the 14th century, echoing Hemingway's 20th century lover, friar and historian Jean de Venette observed, "In many places, not two men remained alive out of 20. The mortality was so great that, for a considerable period, more than 500 bodies a day were being taken in carts from the Hôtel Dieu in Paris for burial in the cemetery of the Holy Innocents. The saintly sisters of the Hôtel Dieu, not fearing death, worked sweetly and with great humility, setting aside considerations of earthly dignity. A great number of the sisters were called to a new life by death, and now rest, it is piously believed, with Christ." Healthcare workers themselves have been keenly aware of their situation during contagious outbreaks. One study combined results from 59 investigations of doctors and nurses coping with epidemics of everything from SARS to MERS to Ebola to influenza to COVID-19. Staff in contact with potentially infected patients reported greater levels of psychological distress and post-traumatic stress disorder. Risk factors for negative psychological outcomes included younger age, having small children, and an absence of practical support from the hospital. The lack of protective equipment was particularly stressful. Negative psychological outcomes were also more common if people were obliged to perform their duties rather than being allowed to volunteer, examples of which we saw earlier with the SARS-1 outbreak in 2003 at the Prince of Wales Hospital in Hong Kong and the SARS-2 outbreak in Italy. And the frequent up-close contact with death can be, I know, very hard. In the middle of March 2020, as expected, reports began to appear of healthcare personnel falling ill and dying of coronavirus they had acquired in the course of their duties. In the United States, hauntingly, nearly 600 healthcare workers had died of COVID-19 by June 2020. In other countries too, from China to Italy to Brazil, many nurses and doctors died as healthcare systems became overwhelmed. An international website started tracking such deaths. As of May 1, 2020, it recorded over 1,000 names from 64 countries, from young medical students to doctors pressed into service post-retirement, ranging in age from 20 to 99. The list makes for powerful reading. Here are just a few. Isaac Abadi, MD, 84, professor of internal medicine and rheumatology, Hospital Universitario de Caracas, Caracas, Venezuela. Luigi Ablondi, 66, epidemiologist, Cremona, Italy. Mamuna Rana, 48, physician, Northeast London Foundation Trust, London, England. Alvin Big Al Sanders, 74, plant operations, maintenance mechanic, Tulane Hospital, New Orleans, Louisiana. Ellen Schreiner, 68, registered nurse, Crossroads Hospice, Dayton, Ohio. Susan Sisgundo, 50, registered nurse, neonatal ICU, Bellevue Hospital, New York City. Arthur Turetsky, pulmonary and critical care physician, Bridgeport Hospital, Bridgeport, Connecticut. Ehsan Vafaka, 38, anesthesiologist, Torbadi Heydare, Iran. Liang Wudong, 62, otorhinolaryngologist, Hubei Xinhua Hospital, Wuhan, China. And hundreds of others, some memorialized just by their first name and hospital. Many of the infections and deaths in healthcare professionals were a direct result of the absence of PPE, as these people were obliged to work unprotected. When I practiced medicine during the HIV epidemic in the 1990s, we took risks when we drew blood or cared for HIV-positive patients. Blood and other body fluids would sometimes splatter on us, and we did worry about infection. HIV was not as transmissible in a healthcare setting as SARS-2, but it was, at the time, deadlier. Still, this risk has always been part of doctoring. Patient care is a calling, not merely a job. But a key difference is that we had proper equipment to reduce our risk. In the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, however, American doctors, nurses, and EMTs were expected to take these risks without adequate equipment to protect themselves. The situation was so appalling that a collaborative group of software engineers and physicians from across the United States banded together and made a website, www.getuspppe.org, to coordinate requests for PPE and possible donors. As of May 2, 2020, there were 6,169 unique requests from all 50 states, with hospitals, outpatient facilities, and nursing homes accounting for the majority. Institutions and individual healthcare workers were especially desperate for N95 respirator masks, which accounted for 74% of the requests. During the first wave of the epidemic, healthcare workers filed 4,100 complaints with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. There were at least 275 fatality investigations related to the lack of PPE, and, as of June 30th, at least 35 hospital workers had died after OSHA received safety complaints about their workplaces. For instance, Barbara Birchenau, 65, worked at the Clara Moss Medical Center in New Jersey as a nurse. On March 25th, she texted her daughter, "The ICU nurses were making gowns out of garbage bags. Dad is going to pick up large garbage bags for me just in case." Later that day, she texted again to note that she had a cough and a headache and that she had been exposed to 6 patients who had tested positive for COVID-19. "Please pray for all healthcare workers," she texted her daughter. "We are running out of supplies." By April 15th, she was dead from the disease. There was something deeply unnerving about the calls put out from big hospitals, such as the Yale New Haven system and the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, asking local citizens for any PPE they might have stashed at home and could spare. No donation is too small, Dartmouth added. The imperative to be generous is hardwired in us, and indeed the survival of our species has depended on an exquisite balance between altruists and free riders, between the people who run into a burning building to save lives and the people who take advantage of others. Across time, humans evolved to live socially, and cooperative impulses won out. Evolutionarily speaking, however, when it comes to our response to collective threats, something even more fundamental than cooperation is going on. The very fact that we knew what to do when the pandemic struck partly reflects another extraordinary ability in our species, the capacity for teaching and learning. Most animals can learn about their environment. A fish in the sea can learn that if it swims up to the light, it will find food there. This is known as independent learning or individual learning. A small number of animal species, including apes, dolphins, and elephants, can learn by watching each other, by imitation and observation. This is known as social learning. A person can put their hand in a fire and learn that it burns independently. Or I can watch that person put their hand in the fire and learn not to do so, socially. I gain almost as much knowledge, but pay none of the price. Another person might eat red berries in the woods and die, and if I watch what happens, I'll learn not to do so myself. Such social learning is incredibly efficient. But people do something even more dramatic than simply learn from one another by copying. We affirmatively and consciously teach each other things. We set out to transmit information from one person to another. Teaching is at the root of the capacity for culture, the ability to accumulate useful knowledge, the ability to share it widely, and the ability to learn from the past. Such teaching is very rare in the animal kingdom, but it is universal in us. The human ability to survive in a diversity of habitats, from the Arctic tundra, where people hunt seals, to the African deserts, where they build wells, has depended only a little on physiological adaptations, such as higher fat stores and shorter stature to conserve heat among people living in the far north. Much more important, human survival in challenging environments, for which our soft bodies alone would otherwise be unsuited, hinges on our capacity for culture, a capacity that is itself ingrained within us and that has allowed us to invent astonishing things like kayaks and parkas. No other species depends quite so much on the ability to create and preserve cultural traditions. One of my favorite examples of this is the transmission of warnings via myths or inscriptions regarding major natural disasters that occur much less frequently than a single human lifespan. The northeast coast of Japan is dotted with so-called tsunami stones, which are large flat rocks, some as tall as 3 meters, with inscribed warnings about where to build villages so as to avoid tsunamis, which can kill tens of thousands of people, or where to flee when they strike. In Anayoshi, a stone was erected a century ago with a warning, "Do not build your homes below this point." Why would people take the time and effort to warn distant descendants or strangers at some unknown future point? And why would those future people heed the warning of the past? When a tsunami struck there in 2011, killing 29,000 people and totally destroying everything in its path, the water stopped just 100 meters below the stone. The people in all 11 households built above the marker survived. They knew the horror of tsunamis, so they erected that stone to warn us, said Tomishige Kimura, speaking of the former residents of his village. Sometimes the ancient wisdom is transmitted by words not inscribed on a rock, as with a village named Namiwake, or Wave's Edge. It is located on a spot more than 6 kilometers from the ocean, marking the devastating reach of a tsunami in 1611. There is also the related phenomenon of designating the low water marks in European rivers. The Elbe River in the Czech Republic is dotted with hunger stones commemorating historic droughts. They have inscriptions like, "If you see me, weep," from as far back as 500 years. Similarly, the Aboriginal tribes of the Andaman and Nicobar Islands in the Indian Ocean have passed down an oral tradition for millennia that advises people, when the earth shakes and the sea recedes, to immediately run to particular locations on higher ground in the forest. These tribes all survived the great tsunami of 2005 that killed thousands of residents of more technologically advanced societies. One good definition of culture is that it is information capable of affecting individuals' behavior that they acquire from other members of their species through teaching, imitation, and other forms of social transmission. A key part of this definition is its interpersonal quality. Culture is a property not of individuals, but of groups. Other scientists put more emphasis on material artifacts, such as tools or art or medicines. But of course, cultural knowledge is also the antecedent of the creation of such objects. Culture can evolve over time. Just like human genetic mutations can lead to improved disease resistance, chance events can lead to better ideas or tools. Superior inventions, such as a Bronze Age sword, can outperform weaker ones, such as a Stone Age axe. And bigger populations facilitate the preservation of discoveries. If an individual stumbles on a better technique for building a fire, finding water, tracking animals, or fabricating a vaccine, there must be someone around to observe, copy, and remember it. Consequently, bigger populations are better suited to social learning and to maximizing opportunities for valuable innovation. Furthermore, teachers and learners must work to keep a complex tradition alive. Larger populations mean more pupils to learn from the best members of a society and also provide for the occasional pupils who can surpass their teacher. Because of the evolution of culture, if you learned calculus in high school, you know, or at least you knew, so much math that if you were moved back 500 years, you would be the most knowledgeable mathematician on the planet. Simply by being born in the 20th or 21st century, you have all of the science, art, and inventions made by all prior humans and recorded in diverse ways, in folklore, in books, online, available to learn. You have available to you, in most parts of the world, a deep understanding of the cosmos, domesticated plants and animals to provide food, electricity and modern medicine, highways and maps, and glass and plastics in addition to bronze, iron, and steel. This is cumulative culture. Human beings endlessly contribute to the accumulated wealth of knowledge that belongs to humanity, and each generation is generally born into greater such wealth. Of course, there are also periodic reversals when knowledge is lost, as happened after the collapse of the Roman Empire, leading to Europeans living in concrete dwellings for 700 years that they lacked the know-how to construct. A few animal species have limited forms of culture, but our type of cumulative culture, across generations and in its elaborate form, is unique. It was this cumulative culture that allowed us to teach each other things about how to cope with the pandemic when it first struck. Even if people had forgotten or did not know what to do, the knowledge was still available for rapid activation. And we had established mechanisms, universities, books, chat rooms for sharing knowledge. Information spread at lightning speed around the world about properties of the virus, about how to control it, and about how to care for its victims. Dozens of studies were put online by Chinese scientists as early as January. And this was all in addition to books we could read about how our ancestors had coped with other devastating plagues in the past. Our capacity for culture is what makes science possible. And that, in turn, allows us to develop pharmaceutical interventions to complement the non-pharmaceutical interventions that we also, even earlier in our history, learned to implement. In fact, a key objective of flattening the curve, to which so much effort was directed, was precisely to give us time to invent new treatments or a vaccine to forestall some of the deaths. One of the most distinctive features of the COVID-19 pandemic is that it is striking us in a century when our knowledge of the human body and medicine, painstakingly accumulated over centuries with an accelerating pace in the past 200 years, allows us to respond in a way wholly unavailable to our ancestors. We can scramble to develop drugs and vaccines to target the virus, adding pharmaceutical interventions to the non-pharmaceutical interventions that were the only tools of centuries past. As we saw in Chapter 3, pharmaceutical interventions have been less important than NPIs in prior epidemics, but there is a real possibility that this will not be the case in our fight against COVID-19. Literally within weeks of the virus leaping into our species, scientists began to develop pharmaceutical countermeasures. By May 2020, over 100 different vaccines of an astonishing variety were already in the works, supported by university laboratories, pharmaceutical companies, and governments around the world. Many of these had entered human trials. However, to put the challenge in perspective, one of the fastest vaccines ever developed, the vaccine for the Ebola virus, approved in 2019, took 5 years. The usual time frame is closer to 10 years. Despite the history of time-consuming efforts to develop vaccines, there is a lot of optimism about the possibility of rapid progress in the case of SARS-2. One reason is that the biology of the coronavirus is less daunting than that of some other viruses, including even the plain old seasonal flu virus. Another reason for optimism has to do with the way the development of this vaccine is being approached. With a broad and rapid line of attack, we are increasing the probability of quick success by attacking the problem from many angles at once. Speed is critical because while a vaccine will be useful no matter when we get it, to really have a significant impact on the course of the pandemic, it has to emerge in much less time than it would take the worldwide population to reach herd immunity. Since that landmark will probably occur after 2 or 3 waves of the pandemic, corresponding to roughly 2 or 3 years, it was unclear to me in the summer of 2020 whether the vaccine would arrive in time to make much of a difference. Even if it were accomplished in record time, many people would already have been infected. And it is hard not to flip-flop between optimism and pessimism, with many scientists arguing it is possible to rapidly develop a safe and effective vaccine, and others expressing skepticism. There are good reasons on both sides of this division, and I have found myself holding both opinions at different times. But the very prospect of developing a vaccine, regardless of the speed, depends on decades of prior painstaking work, extensive accumulation of technical knowledge, cooperation among scientists around the world, and the altruistic sacrifices of countless patients who volunteered for previous pharmaceutical trials. Generations of patients, scientists, and physicians struggled to accumulate and preserve the knowledge that humans might now be the beneficiaries of. For many diseases, it has been impossible to develop a vaccine. Human bodies are incredibly complex, and it is difficult to forecast how we will respond to vaccines as a species, let alone how any particular individual will respond. For example, after 4 decades, we do not have a vaccine against HIV, nor do we have a vaccine against many of the viruses that cause the common cold, though the demand for both is huge. But still, there are so many different approaches to developing a vaccine for SARS-2 that the variety offers a sense both of the likelihood of success and of human ingenuity. The first step toward a vaccine was taken early on, as physicians observed that humans made antibodies in the course of recovering from COVID-19. This confirmed that it was possible to elicit an effective immune response of particular kinds. Furthermore, the existence of COVID-19 survivors allowed us to immediately deploy a century-old technology that was successfully used during the 1918 flu pandemic. Injecting patients with convalescent serum, the fluid part of the blood, extracted from recovered patients, as in the case of the Orthodox Jews from Brooklyn. Patients who have survived COVID-19 make antibodies to the virus. These antibodies circulate in their blood, and they can be extracted and transfused into seriously ill patients where they help disable the virus. Early reports confirmed the effectiveness of this approach against SARS-2, but larger, formal trials are needed. Regardless, the supply from donors is limited, and convalescent serum does not prevent the disease. Vaccines seek to elicit a long-term, protective, natural immune response in people, but without the risk of actually giving them the disease. The human body has an immune system with multiple components, including circulating antibodies and specialized cells that also attack microbes. These interlocking systems naturally fight invading organisms and can remember the invaders our bodies have encountered before. To understand vaccine development, it's helpful to understand what exactly the vaccine is trying to repel. The coronavirus infects cells by using the spike proteins on its surface to bind to proteins on the surface of human cells, known as ACE2 receptors, especially those cells that line the respiratory tract, but other tissues as well, as we saw in Chapter 1. After a sequence of steps, the virus enters the cell, where it takes over cellular machinery in order to reproduce itself, releasing more virus into the body, which can both harm the individual and spread to other people. Ordinarily, as the body tries to repel the invader, certain specialized cells engulf the virus and then display parts of it to other cells, known as helper T cells, like a child showing you the food in his mouth so you can assess what he is eating. This subsequently assists so-called B cells in making antibodies against the virus and in initiating other bodily defenses. In the case of COVID-19, most patients produce sufficient antibodies within a few days to clear the infection. In parallel with this, a different kind of T cell, known as a cytotoxic T cell, can learn to identify and destroy human cells that are infected with a virus. Crucially, some of these immunological defenses record the nature of the invader, and this information stays in the system for a long time after the acute infection. These records are collectively known as memory immunity. In 2020, scientists tried to activate this natural system using a number of approaches. The oldest approach involved giving people something known as a live attenuated virus. This is old technology. Cowpox is a disease that usually infects cows, but it can sometimes infect humans too, giving them a mild disease that resembles smallpox, although smallpox is much deadlier. Noting the folk wisdom that milkmaids were immune to smallpox, on May 14, 1796, English physician Edward Jenner conducted an experiment. He scraped some pus from cowpox blisters on the hands of a milkmaid named Sarah Nelmes, and then injected it into James Phipps, the 8-year-old son of his gardener. He conveniently overlooked the option of trying out the procedure on his own children. Jenner inoculated Phipps in both arms, and Phipps developed a fever and felt sick. 2 months later, crucially and almost unbelievably, Jenner injected Phipps on two occasions with material from smallpox blisters taken from another human. And Phipps did not develop smallpox. Jenner's unique contribution was not that he decided to infect people with cowpox, but that he thought to prove, by these subsequent challenges, that the subjects were thereafter truly immune to smallpox. Jenner called the procedure vaccination, after the Latin word for cow, vacca. Today, we still use variations of this idea, trying to artificially develop mild variants of an otherwise deadly virus. Weakened forms of a virus are created by allowing the virus to grow and infect animal or human cells in vitro repeatedly for hundreds of generations until it picks up mutations that make it less able to cause disease in humans. The trick is to do this just right so that the virus does not make someone ill, but still elicits a good memory immune response. The vaccines for smallpox, chickenpox, rotavirus, measles, and mumps all work in this fashion. Indeed, because this approach so closely approximates a natural infection, live attenuated virus vaccines are among the most effective methods of vaccination known, usually conferring very good and long-term immunity. Moderately successful veterinary vaccines for various coronavirus species used in pigs, cows, cats, and so on have been of the live attenuated variety, which raises hope for similar success in humans. Closely related to this approach is the use of an inactivated virus. Here, instead of trying to create a new mutated strain, researchers treat the virus with chemicals, heat, or some other process so as to render it unable to cause infection while remaining immunogenic. These kinds of vaccines often require booster shots. The vaccines for hepatitis A and the seasonal flu fall into this category. Already by April 2020, Chinese scientists at a company called Sinovac had begun testing a vaccine of this type. They completed trials in monkeys very soon after the epidemic began, and human Phase 1 trials started in Jiangsu Province, north of Shanghai, that month. A further approach is to use parts of the virus, specifically protein fragments, to elicit an immune response. A protein alone cannot infect a person with a virus it comes from, but it can trigger antibody production. The difficult part is triggering a strong enough response to fight the actual virus off. Many successful vaccines fall into this category, including those for shingles, HPV, hepatitis B, and meningococcus. Still another approach, which has never previously been employed successfully, is to use nucleic acids from the virus instead of proteins, that is, to use fragments of DNA or RNA that resemble the genetic information of the virus. In the case of the DNA approach, the idea is to instruct the body to make a viral protein inside its own cells, as if it had been infected by the virus, and this in turn elicits the usual immune response. A variant of this approach is to add DNA that matches the genes of a virus to an entirely different species of another, milder virus. This altered virus is then injected into the body, once again initiating an immune response. The RNA approach is similar to the foregoing, but it offers some additional benefits, namely that human bodies could, in the case of coronavirus, come to recognize the RNA itself as alien and possibly learn to attack it directly in ways that are helpful in warding off future infections. Injecting people with DNA or RNA so that it might be taken up by their cells and produce viral proteins may sound scary, but this is actually a less toxic way of doing what the virus does to people anyway. The molecules being injected into our bodies are a far cry from the actual virus itself. The first coronavirus vaccine developed in the United States was an RNA vaccine of the type just discussed, produced by Moderna Therapeutics on February 24, 2020, just 42 days after the gene sequence of the virus was published in China. The first participant in the first trial of this agent was dosed on March 16th. This is astonishing speed. On that date, there were just 4,609 known cases of the disease in the United States and only 95 known deaths. By May 19, 2020, scientists reported preliminary results from the trial, and the vaccine showed promise. There are still other approaches to making a vaccine beyond those noted earlier. And there is other technical know-how that goes into all these approaches, painstakingly accumulated over decades by human beings who learned from and collaborated with one another to make it possible for us to survive diseases that wiped out entire populations in previous eras. A further wonderful example of the accumulation of cultural knowledge across time and bequeathed to future humans like us is found in the development of something known as adjuvants, which are often used as components of vaccines. During the 1920s, a French veterinarian named Gaston Ramon made major contributions to the development of vaccines for diphtheria and tetanus, which were leading causes of death at that time, based on a method he developed that used formaldehyde to inactivate the deadly toxins these pathogens produced. This chemical treatment rendered the toxins ineffective at causing illness, but still able to elicit a protective immune response. A very similar process is still used in vaccines for these conditions manufactured today. Ramon was nominated for a Nobel Prize at least 155 times, the most of anyone who did not go on to win the prize, and, to my mind, his contributions were surely on par with many who did win. In the process of experimenting with this, however, Ramon noticed that horses being injected with diphtheria had a stronger immune response, that is, a higher level of antibodies in their blood, when they showed evidence of irritation at the injection site. The horses were being deliberately infected, in part so scientists could harvest these antibodies and use them to treat humans for diphtheria, a treatment approach that earned a different scientist the Nobel Prize in 1901. A similar process is used nowadays to create antitoxins against snake venoms, since huge horses can easily survive small amounts of poison. This also resembles the convalescent serum treatment for COVID-19 noted earlier. Ramon came to wonder whether he could deliberately foster such irritation, thereby somehow heightening the immune response of the horse, by adding irritating chemicals to the substance being injected. He experimented with tapioca starch and aluminum salts, substances still in use today in human vaccines. Around the same time, incidentally, British immunologist Alexander Glennie independently observed something similar. If humans were given a diphtheria vaccine that had aluminum salts, they seemed to develop stronger immunity. Over the years, researchers have tried adding all kinds of irritants, including seaweed proteins and even breadcrumbs. Scientists have continued to explore the biology of this, and pharmaceutical companies have developed more and more effective irritants. For example, the vaccine against the virus that causes shingles has a special mix, a witch's brew of fats and proteins from Salmonella bacteria, along with extracts from the Chilean soap bark tree. None of these substances has anything to do with the virus that causes shingles, but they nevertheless help the vaccine to work. Step by step, working together, we accumulate knowledge over time and share it widely. By enhancing the immunogenicity of the actual active agent, adjuvants make it possible to give lower doses of the vaccine, which means more people can be vaccinated and at lower risk. Consequently, many of the vaccines under development for SARS-2 involve sophisticated plans to thoughtfully deploy such adjuvants. And companies with advanced technology of this type, including GlaxoSmithKline, have committed to making their proven adjuvant substances available for use with COVID-19 vaccines developed by other groups. The deployment of ingenious technologies to help us tackle the pandemic was breathtaking in still further ways. As part of their contribution, some scientists attempted to create genetically engineered animals that express the human form of the ACE2 protein, the one that the coronavirus latches onto, which would allow still other scientists to more rapidly assess the efficacy of the vaccines they were developing. A whole independent set of technological tools, building on years of science, was brought to bear simply to develop a tool that would be used to tackle the virus, like the technologies developed to make styrofoam cups that are then merged with entirely different ones required to harvest and prepare coffee. There's such an amazing amount of knowledge and work that comes together. It's beautiful and mind-boggling. It's hard even to estimate how many years of effort by scientists, doctors, engineers, and others collaborating, often simply by sharing knowledge, have been required to help our species cope with this new coronavirus. Still, there are lots of unknown factors that will shape how virus research develops. A big one at the beginning of the vaccine development efforts is precisely how strong immunity to SARS-2 is and how long it will last, whether that immunity is prompted by natural infection or vaccination. There is no way to accelerate the acquisition of such knowledge. We simply have to wait for time to pass. Prior studies, done with one of the species of coronavirus that causes the common cold and with SARS-1, have shown that the initial antibody response wanes with time, lasting about a year, but that people nevertheless still retained potent memory immunity based on memory T cells. Another crucial factor is safety. The usual rate of serious complications for approved human vaccines is approximately 1 out of 1 million recipients. The seasonal flu vaccine might kill 1 out of 10 million people to whom it is given, a figure that is clearly offset by the thousands of lives saved annually by the vaccine. But no matter how many lives a vaccine saves, safety is a serious issue, especially in some populations, like children, who face relatively less risk of getting or succumbing to COVID-19. Some vaccine candidates for other coronaviruses actually made the infection worse in animal testing, in part by worsening the natural way the animal's body attempted to fight off the infection. Another risk is that if the wrong kind of immune response is elicited, the body might attack itself in what is known as an autoimmune reaction. This happened with the flu vaccine in 1976, when many patients developed a kind of paralysis from which most people recovered, known as Guillain-Barré syndrome. Rushing to bring a vaccine to market could also cause other sorts of safety problems in its manufacturing. Infamously, this happened in the Qatar incident during the early launch of the polio vaccine in 1955. When the polio vaccine was made available, mass vaccination days were organized by local communities. More than 120,000 children received a batch of the vaccine in which the process of inactivating the live virus was incomplete. Within days, there were reports of children developing paralysis, and the mass immunization program was abandoned within a month. Investigation showed that 2 batches of the vaccine, manufactured by Qatar laboratories, had the live virus, resulting in symptoms in 40,000 people, permanent paralysis in 51, and death in 5. And this does not include cases of the virus spreading to other children. This episode was described as a perfect storm of sloppy company practices, greed, and lax federal oversight, leading to a tragedy for the victims. It's hard to move with both speed and prudence. A survey in May 2020 revealed that 73% of Americans were confident a vaccine would be developed. Still, 64% said that scientists and companies should take the time they need to ensure that pharmaceuticals are safe. But in the rush to develop a COVID-19 vaccine, some pharmaceutical companies are skipping some crucial steps, such as trials in animals, and neglecting needed preliminary work in small groups of humans, which might adversely affect the safety of the resulting vaccine. I am concerned that a vaccine that seems safe in trials will be revealed to have problems when administered to millions of people. Any adverse reactions are sure to be breathlessly covered by the media, reducing public interest in vaccination when it is most needed. Another unusual step taken to accelerate availability is the construction of manufacturing facilities even before a vaccine is proven effective or approved. Philanthropist Bill Gates has said that he would financially support, at tremendous cost, the construction of 7 different factories using different manufacturing methods in advance of knowing which vaccines might work. Similarly, drug companies have indicated that they are ramping up production capabilities even before knowing if their candidate vaccines are effective. There is much to worry about in the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. This is a new virus for which new vaccine approaches are being attempted, requiring novel manufacturing procedures as well. However, we could wind up with more than one type of vaccine in the end, and some types may be more or less suitable for particular populations, such as children, the elderly, the immunocompromised, and so on. No matter when a safe and effective vaccine appears, it will help to prevent deaths from COVID-19. The efforts to find drugs that can treat COVID-19 have proceeded with similar levels of international cooperation, speed, and ingenuity. Within a few months of the onset of the epidemic, dozens of chemicals were being repurposed or proposed as treatments for the virus. Clinical trials were launched, often reflecting partnerships between pharmaceutical companies, universities, governments, and even international bodies such as the World Health Organization. For example, in March 2020, the WHO initiated what it called the Solidarity Trial in 10 countries, enrolling thousands of patients infected with SARS-2 to explore the potential utility of four existing antiviral medications previously used for other viruses. The variety of drugs studied has been impressive, ranging from hydroxychloroquine, which we discussed in Chapter 4, to an antiviral medication known as remdesivir that inhibits RNA synthesis, to other medications acting in biochemically ingenious ways, such as favipiravir or lopinavir, to various human monoclonal antibodies, to steroids, and many other drugs and approaches. An important trial from remdesivir appeared in May 2020 and showed that the drug could decrease the amount of time patients spent in intensive care by a few days. To be clear, this was a modest outcome and applied only to severely ill patients. The investigators were not able to show that the drug could prevent death, regardless of its impact on hospitalization duration. Nor were they trying to show that the drug could prevent progression to serious disease among the much larger population of infected but not sick people. But still, even if it did not ultimately prove to have those other beneficial effects, the drug could have other benefits for our society. Freeing up ICU capacity is a crucial objective. On June 16, 2020, it was announced that a steroid known as dexamethasone could actually reduce mortality in hospitalized patients. The announcement came via a press release from Oxford University. A scientific paper followed a couple of weeks later, indicating how important the investigators felt it was to rapidly, publicly share the information. Dexamethasone is very inexpensive and widely available. It was discovered in 1957 as part of work conducted by Philip Showalter Hensch on the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. Steroids as a class, and dexamethasone in particular, suppress the immune system, which appeared to provide relief for patients whose lungs were ravaged by the overactive immune response that sometimes arises later in the course in severe cases of COVID-19. But patients still need functioning immune systems to fend off the virus itself. This is a tricky balance. The proper moment to use the drug may depend on the course of illness in particular patients. In the trial, a total of 2,104 patients were randomized to receive dexamethasone for 10 days, and they were compared to 4,321 patients who got usual care. Overall, the drug reduced the 28-day mortality rate by 17%. This large reduction in mortality was welcome news. But the drug showed the greatest benefit among those sicker patients requiring intubation. Indeed, there was a hint in the findings that the patients who did not require ventilators might have done slightly worse on the drug, perhaps by interfering with the ability of the immune system to ward off the virus. Developing, testing, and deploying drugs is not easy. Still, the emergence of drugs, such as remdesivir and dexamethasone, and others to come, vindicated the whole strategy of deploying the non-pharmaceutical interventions to flatten the curve. By buying time, we allowed ourselves the opportunity to use our capacities for teaching and learning in order to enhance our survival. One classic study of immunity and symptoms related to coronavirus, involving the 229E strain, which causes the common cold, published in 1990, involved an odd twist. 15 volunteers were deliberately infected with the virus. They all went on to develop cold symptoms, and the amount of circulating antibodies in their blood was periodically monitored for a year, at which point the levels were observed to be very low. But had their immunity waned completely? Or did they have some memory immunity? There was only one way to know for sure. 9 of the 15 volunteers agreed to be challenged, that is, they went back to the lab to be deliberately reinfected with the virus. Although their antibody titers were extremely low or undetectable at the time, they indeed still had some immunity, since only 6 of the 9 became reinfected with the virus, and none developed symptoms. Vaccine and drug development is usually extraordinarily laborious. The process costs around $1 billion from start to finish, and it typically takes 10 years. Even in late stages of drug development, when human trials have already begun and people are excited about the promise of the drug being evaluated, it is not uncommon for toxic side effects to emerge and the drug to be abandoned. Drugs are scrapped as much as 50% of the time, even late in the process. When new chemical agents are developed, not existing drugs that are simply being evaluated for a new use, like dexamethasone, little is known about their safety, toxicity, and pharmacokinetics. The process is even more confusing, and in vitro studies with human cells or with animals are done to try to get a handle on those parameters. This is where the human tendency to altruism and cooperation becomes really helpful. Testing drugs always requires volunteers willing to assume some risk by taking a new and incompletely understood pharmaceutical agent. Ultimately, there must be some first-in-human or first-human dose studies, known as Phase 1 studies. These studies are then followed by Phase 2 studies, which involve slightly larger numbers of subjects and attempt to further explore the safety of the drug and, more important, get an initial sense of its efficacy. If this phase is promising, then Phase 3 studies, involving a much larger number of people in a randomized controlled trial, are initiated with an eye to quantifying the actual efficacy of the drug. In such pivotal Phase 3 studies, one group of people is randomly assigned to get the active agent, and another, the control group, gets either a placebo or whatever constitutes the usual standard of care. During Phase 3, scientists also assess the possible emergence of rare toxicities that could not have been observed in the small Phase 1 and Phase 2 studies. Finally, even after a drug is released, ongoing monitoring is necessary to make sure the pharmaceutical works in a broader, representative sample of people who get it, and to check for even rarer toxicities. This is known as Phase 4. The rates of the outcomes of interest, illness, death, toxicities, and so on, are monitored and compared in the two groups in a Phase 3 study, the treatment group and the control group. In the case of a vaccine trial, this can take as long as a year, while researchers wait for patients to be exposed to and possibly get the disease naturally. If fewer patients in the group that got the vaccine go on to develop the illness than in the group that did not get the vaccine, this provides the evidence needed that the vaccine works to prevent infection. But a problem emerged as COVID-19 vaccine trials got underway. In many parts of the world, such as in China, because of NPIs like mask wearing and work closures, not enough people were getting sick to allow for efficient testing of the vaccines. Since the efficacy of the vaccine is assessed by comparing how many people who got the vaccine contracted COVID-19, compared to how many people who did not get the vaccine contracted it, a low incidence of COVID-19 means that very large numbers of subjects had to be enrolled. If no one gets exposed to the virus naturally, there is no way to test the vaccine. Ironically, success in deploying non-pharmaceutical interventions to control the disease made it harder to assess the efficacy of pharmaceutical interventions. For this reason, and in order to accelerate Phase 3 of a vaccine trial, some scientists proposed an alternative to simply waiting for people to get sick with COVID-19 naturally. They could do what Jenner did, and what the 229E coronavirus study did, affirmatively challenge vaccinated people by deliberately infecting them with SARS-2. Of course, giving volunteers the live SARS-2 virus risks disabling or killing them. But accelerating the development of a vaccine could significantly reduce death and disease in the population at large. And the risk to volunteers could be minimized if the volunteers were young and healthy, received excellent care, or were otherwise already at high risk of infection, meaning that they had something to gain and less to lose from participating. For instance, good candidates for such an experiment would be healthcare workers or, conversely, people who were caring for chronically ill relatives and who wanted to avoid getting COVID-19 for fear of transmitting it to their loved ones. Once again, given the altruism in our species, such volunteers emerged. Josh Morrison, who lives in Brooklyn, New York, leads a nonprofit that tries to make kidney donation easier. In 2011, he donated a kidney himself, accepting a small risk of death in order to save the life of a stranger. Helping to accelerate the development of a vaccine for COVID-19 by taking a similar risk, he reasoned, could save thousands of lives. After hearing about the possibility of challenge trials, he established COVID Challenge, a hub for people to volunteer and to advocate for safe and rapid vaccine development. Over 1,550 people signed up by April 2020. Journalist Connor Friedersdorf interviewed some of them. One of them was Gabrielle Kleinwax, a 23-year-old studying mechanical engineering at the University of Colorado at Boulder. As a Jew, she had always been moved by the Talmudic saying, "He who saves a life saves the world entire." And so she said, "I'm lucky in a lot of ways, including good health. I'm young. I don't get sick a lot. This seems like a way that I can share some of that luck. I empathize with other people. The pain of losing someone you care about is the same, no matter who you are. Anything to reduce that amount of pain is something I should try to do." Furthermore, she continued, "there's the risk of participating in a human trial, but there's also the risk of just walking around. It's not that I'm not afraid of the virus. I am. But the trial didn't seem like an enormous added risk." Another volunteer, Mabel Rosenheck, a 35-year-old historian at Temple University in Philadelphia, explained her motivations as follows. "The risks that other people are taking on are so much bigger in terms of doctors and nurses, grocery store workers, people who are out there every day. The risk that I could take would be comparable, but not even as strong, because I would have good medical care and people watching over me right from the start." Still more cooperation is required beyond what is needed to develop and test the pharmaceutical interventions. People still need to actually get the vaccine for their own and everyone else's benefit. Evidence emerged in May 2020 that the percentage of individuals who said they would likely get a hypothetical vaccine declined in parallel with waning fear of the pathogen at that time. Given the misinformation about vaccine risks, the baseline anti-vax movement, and, perhaps most important, the political polarization that has unfortunately come to characterize many aspects of our collective response to the COVID-19 pandemic, it could require significant effort to persuade everyone to get the vaccine. For a vaccine to work on a collective level and confer herd immunity, people would have to once again cooperate. As we saw before, given the R-naught of SARS-2, roughly 67% of the population needs to be immunized. One poll in early May indicated that 72% of Americans would get a vaccine if one were available. The willingness varied by race. 74% of whites were willing, compared to 54% of blacks, despite the greater burden of the disease in black people. This perhaps reflects the shameful legacy of racist medical experimentation in our country that has left a residue of suspicion of the medical establishment in some African Americans. Political affiliation also seemed to play a role, and 79% of Democrats expressed willingness to be vaccinated, compared with 65% of Republicans. However, another national poll, conducted in May 2020, found that, among those planning to receive a vaccine when it became available, 93% said they would do it to protect themselves. Nearly as many, 88%, said they would do it to protect their families. And 78% said they would get a vaccine because, I want to protect my community. Such pro-social motivations are ever present. As we discussed in Chapter 4, epidemics foster fear and anxiety. These psychological states, like the germs themselves, spread from person to person. But good ideas also spread from person to person. Even though the pathogen is exploiting our species' evolved and quite natural tendency to gather in groups, there are other parts of our evolved sociability that the pathogen does not change. We evolved one of the great mysteries of evolutionary biology, the capacity to make sacrifices for each other, to cooperate, and to teach each other. Darwin himself was perplexed by how it could be that such altruism arose, evolutionarily speaking. How could selfish creatures make sacrifices to help others? And yet humans do this all the time. These capacities for altruism, cooperation, and teaching, which are so fundamental to us, are ones that the virus does not destroy. And it is these capacities that will allow us to confront it. Even as we maintain physical distance, we can still band together to fight the virus. In the 1990s, during the HIV pandemic, about one-third of the hospice patients in Chicago where I worked were dying, brutally, of AIDS. A further third were dying of cancer, and the final third were dying of all remaining conditions combined. The AIDS patients were mostly young men. It was awful to witness their deaths. The first effective drug against the condition, azithromycin, or AZT, had been released in 1987, but the disease was generally still a death sentence. AIDS activists, such as Larry Kramer, the American playwright who founded ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, and who died at age 84 on May 27, 2020, vigorously pressured the government to do more, to support more research, to take the disease more seriously. Among his targets was Dr. Anthony Fauci, who was already leading NIAID at the time, and who was frequently made aware of Kramer's frustration. At the activist's death, Fauci was quoted as saying, "It was an extraordinary 33-year relationship. We loved each other." Famously, as part of their Storm the NIH campaign, ACT UP organized a march by hundreds of protesters to the bucolic campus of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, on May 21, 1990. Carrying signs reading, "Red tape kills us," and chanting, "NIH, you can't hide, we charge you with genocide," they were met by 200 riot police on horseback. But they succeeded in changing the agenda for drug development. In 1995, after much effort, a drug known as saquinavir, a protease inhibitor, was discovered. It became part of a three-drug regimen composed of saquinavir, didioxycytidine, DDC, and AZT, a combination called Highly Active Antiretroviral Therapy, or HART. In 1996, results from two pivotal randomized controlled trials, involving a total of over 1,200 volunteers and supported by NIAID, showed that HART was extremely effective. Though the side effects were considerable and the daily dosing regimens very complex, it was life-saving. With HART, many patients saw the viral load of HIV in their blood become undetectable. And over the course of just a few months in early 1997, our hospice program virtually stopped having to care for any HIV patients. Just like that. HART converted a disease that was uniformly fatal into one that could be managed for a very long time, almost like any other chronic illness. It was incredible. Following the success of HART, in 2003, President George W. Bush launched PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the largest international single-disease initiative in history. It is credited with saving many millions of lives, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa. All this is what cooperation and teaching were able to accomplish. And this is how, in the end, we will defeat the virus. By connecting, volunteering, and learning, we can affirmatively work together to outlast the predations and limit the damage of such a tiny thing.